All right, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. My name is Janice Bellucci, and this is the monthly Zoom meeting for the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We also call ourselves AXL or the Alliance. The date today is, in fact, August 16th, and I welcome you. I welcome you to the monthly Zoom meeting. So we have a lot to talk about today. Thanks, Rafael, for the good morning there, everyone. And it's an exciting time. There's just no doubt about it. Every time we run up against a challenge, I try to remind myself that, you know what, this is an opportunity. We just need to turn it around and look at it from a different perspective. So having that perspective, I can tell you we have a lot of potential opportunities out there, and we'll be talking about several of them today. So before we get started with the meeting, I've asked Marty Weiss to speak, and Marty is a leader in the emotional support group meetings that are held twice a month, I believe, Marty, right? And he'll tell you all the de okay, he'll tell you all the details about it. And I highly encourage people to, in fact, participate in emotional support group meetings because, quite frankly, they cover territory that we don't cover in these monthly Zoom meetings. I am a lawyer, I'm an attorney, and I'm a counselor. I kind of call it counselor with a little C, but I don't do emotional counseling. I'm here to basically give you information about new laws, new regulations, and really, quite frankly, give you hope while trying to avoid many of the pitfalls here for people who are required to register. So take it away, Marty.
Thank you, Janice. So we all know the traumatic effects of the registry on ourselves and on our loved ones. Bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends. Life can be very difficult. I mean, securing work, housing, just having friends in our lives. It can be very difficult. It's also obvious that we are living in dark times overall right now. That's why AXL runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on Thursday and 1 week from today. And yes, not just for registrants, our loved ones and our supporters are more than welcome to join too. Every Thursday evening, AXL board member Sherry Moreno runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist and AXL board member Alex Gittinger leads the Saturday Zoom meetings. The time, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. At every meeting, we have a friendly community supporting each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant so we don't have trolls, bullies, law enforcement, no Proud Boys, no haters, no one who would cause us any grief. So, how can you get access to participate in these wonderful support groups? Please see the information that I will post in the chat moments after I finish this announcement. You can also click on the link on the homepage of the AXL website. And I promise, after participating in the AXL emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. And I'd just like to add, I'd rather be a registrant at an AXL emotional support group meeting with mutually caring friends than to be a civilian of Ukraine right now, knowing that after yesterday's fiasco of a press conference, that a missile could sky in on my home at any second. So again, if you're feeling lonely, you're having difficulty with loss of family and friends, just having difficulty at all, come on in and join us because we would love to help you out as we help each other. Thank you, Janice.
And thank you, Marty. So please, please, please listen to what I've said and to what Marty has said. These emotional support group meetings are for you. They are, in fact, support. They're basically led by people who care and who have your best interests in mind. And those meetings are quite different than our meetings today. Today, we're going to talk about the law. We're going to talk about regulations. We're going to talk about some cases that have been recently decided. We are not going to talk about people's feelings. We just don't have time. But those meetings are so valuable. And I have seen people who participate in the meetings on a regular basis, and I've just seen them flourish. So they went from barely surviving to, in fact, thriving. And so I know that they can help you as well. Okay, so thank you, Marty. And Roger, I believe you put in the chat room down there information about how to connect to the emotional support group meetings. It's really important that you basically have a connection first before you, in fact, join the meetings. And really, we're doing this to protect the people in the emotional support group meetings. We don't want trolls. We don't want government. These meetings are only for people who are on the registry and their loved one. So again, please, please, please join emotional support group meeting. Okay. Okay, and so I'm expecting several board members to join us. I know there are two board members present right now. One of them is Roger Honeycutt. He is on the Axcel Board of Directors. Hi, Roger. Good morning. Thank you for helping me. He's helping me now by admitting people into the meeting, and I do appreciate that. We also have Rick Chu, and Rick is the newest board member on the foundation, the Family Safety Foundation. So we have two organizations here that support you in different ways. And Rick is in fact a member of the foundation board. I think that Monique, also known as Mona, is here with us as well. And I welcome Mona. And I just noticed that Ellie Miller has joined us, and Ellie is an Axcel board member as well as a criminal defense attorney. And so I know she's going to be able to answer some of the questions that I can't answer today because I am a civil attorney. So again, welcome, welcome. This in fact is a meeting on Saturday. It's August 16th. I'm going to go ahead at the beginning of this meeting and announce the date of the next meeting, which I rarely do. But here we go. September 20 is the next Zoom meeting date. So today is August 16th, and then the next meeting is September 20th. I will tell you that the October meeting is going to happen at a slightly different time than usual because of a scheduling conflict that I have. So, what are we going to talk about today? Believe it or not, one of the things I'm going to say, the first thing I'm going to talk about, doesn't really directly involve our organization, but an allied organization, and that is NARSOL. So, NARSOL was in fact scheduled to conduct a conference in Michigan in June, and that conference got canceled, and for a variety of reasons. And I don't think we need to beat a dead horse here, but the bottom line is this: that the hotel where they were to hold the conference did in fact cancel their contract, and therefore they could not have their conference. So it took them a little while to get settled and try to figure out what to do next. And what they've decided to do is to have their conference in October. And in fact, the dates are October 17 through October 19. And now Roger's just put a link there. Thank you, Roger, about their new conference dates. And the new location is Atlanta. So they had their conference last year in Atlanta. It was a successful conference. The hotel did not change their mind at the last minute about whether or not they could, in fact, hold the conference there. So they're going back, I think, to the location where the conference was held last year. And the dates are October 17 through 19. I know we have an article about this on our website. And of course, you can go to the NARSOL website as well to sign up for it. I plan to be there. June, I couldn't attend because of schedule conflict, but I can in fact attend it in October, so I'm going in October. Okay, so that's what's going on there. Another news flash here has to do with the Halloween sign litigation that's been pending the state of Missouri for some time. And so just yesterday afternoon, in fact, I got a notice that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, it has invited me to come and make an oral argument before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals about that case. So I'm really excited about it. It's one, you know, this case has been going on for a very long time. We have a wonderful result from the trial court judge. And I hope you all remember that the trial court judge ultimately issued a permanent statewide injunction. Those are like, to me, that's like winning the Academy Awards as an attorney, right? It's like, oh my gosh, statewide permanent injunction, which basically prevented the state of Missouri from enforcing its Halloween sign requirement last year. So, and the year before, there was a temporary restraining order issued by the same judge. So the last 2 years, 2023 and 2024, registrants in the state of Missouri did not have to post a sign on the front door of their home. All right. This trial court judge has been, I think, brilliant in understanding that when the government requires you to put a sign on the front door of your home, that is indeed compelled speech because the government is compelling you to do this. And so I'm looking forward to presenting the best case possible to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The date is, in fact, September 16th. So September 16th in St. Louis, Missouri. By the way, these hearings are open to the public if you wish to join us. The information is available on the Axcel website. It's going to be short and sweet. I'll just remind you, warn you, I guess. And what I'm saying is they only give us 15 minutes to speak. And oh, by the way, during the 15 minutes, they spend most of the time asking you questions. So we'll see how that goes. I remember when I argued my first and only case before the California Supreme Court, they warned us. They said, look, you only get 2 or maybe it was 3 minutes, and the rest of the time we're going to ask you questions. So I haven't dug into the rules yet deeply for the oral arguments before Eighth Circuit, but it's probably going to be about the same. In other words, I get to speak for 2 or 3 minutes, and then they get to, rapid fire ask me questions after that. But you know what? I shall be prepared. And this is a really, really important issue for Axel. I hope everybody understands, because we know if you have to put a sign on the front door of your home on Halloween, there's the danger of that day, but then there's a future danger as well. So what am I talking about, the danger of that day? On Halloween, you basically, people in Missouri, rather, were identifying themselves as, I am a sex offender, right? And putting it on the front door of their home. Now, their neighbors could find this information out if they just took a little bit of, made a little bit of effort and go on the Megan's Law website. But instead, the state of Missouri was affirmatively requiring people on the registry to put a sign on the front door, which did not literally say, I am a sex offender, but basically that was the impact of it. Because guess what? The police were out there telling everybody, oh, if you see a sign on the door, this is what it means. And there are media articles and everything else. So anyway, September 16 is the date. They've scheduled 5 cases to be heard that morning, well, starting at 9 o'clock that morning. I don't know how long things will go, but it's possible it will be over by noon, but I can't promise that. So anyway, if you can join us on September 16th in St. Louis, Missouri, I will be there. And hopefully the Eighth Circuit will ask all the right questions. By the way, I do want to say at this point in time, I hold the Eighth Circuit in high regard, and there's a reason for it. So way back when in the trial court case, the judge issued a temporary restraining order. The judge did that right before Halloween. It was the Friday before Halloween. And the Attorney General of Missouri did not like that TRO. And so basically the Attorney General filed spent all weekend filing a brief, and then they turned around that I had just been. Actually, they filed their brief on Friday afternoon, or I can't even remember anymore. It was such an unpleasant experience. I choose not to remember the details, but I spent the entire weekend working on a reply. So the attorney general filed a motion basically to stop the temporary restraining order. And by the way, it seems like the attorney general of Missouri likes to talk a lot on paper. And so when the AG filed that brief, they did it for two reasons. They asked for two things. One, they had to ask for permission to for filing a brief that was too long. So believe it or not, we have rules like that, folks, the attorneys. So we only have X number of pages that we can file a brief. But the attorney general exceeded that amount by 50%. So first, the attorney general had to ask for permission to file a brief that was too long. And then the second thing they asked was, in fact, for the Eighth Circuit to stop temporary restraining order. Well, I was only too pleased to read the Eighth Circuit's decision, which was two sentences long. Think about it. Two sentences. Who? What authority figure, makes decision in two sentences? Well, the Eighth Circuit did. And this is what the Eighth Circuit said in that situation. The Eighth Circuit said, you want to file a brief that's 50% too long? Okay. The second sentence said, and we deny your request for a stay of the temporary restraining order. So the TRO, the temporary restraining order, was in effect that year in 2023. And guess what? The state of Missouri could not enforce the Halloween sign requirement that year. So, we'll see
Good
if
morning,
it's.
Janice.
Good morning. Who are you?
Good morning. I'm sorry to interrupt, Janice. This is David. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine, David. How can we help you? David, by
Great.
the way, is a board member, folks. How can we help you,
Yep,
David?
that's me. Hey, a quick question about this Missouri case.
Yes.
Do you happen to know would their ruling, assuming we get a ruling, would the ruling be just for Missouri, or would it be for like a whole district of several states, or what do you think?
Oh, it's only for the state of Missouri because that's the only thing that's the only issue before them.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. I will say nearby Arkansas did in fact have one county in Arkansas anyway, had a similar requirement. And we sued them and we won. Well, actually, they settled the case right away after the judge basically told them they were being foolish. So it's nice when that happens as well. Okay, so those are kind of the announcements. I wanted to start off talking about something that I mentioned last month, but it bears repeating because unfortunately the impact of it has not gone away. So there was a decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court in the month of July. Its name is Trump versus CASA, and it has to do with immigrants and babies being born in the United States to people who aren't U.S. citizens, et cetera, et cetera. That part of the decision makes no difference to us and our community. The part that does make a difference is, in fact, has to do with injunctive relief. So remember, I just was talking about Missouri and how the trial judge issued a temporary restraining order. Then he issued a preliminary injunction, and now it's a permanent statewide injunction. So what the U.S. Supreme Court said is that they don't like that kind of injunctive relief. And so they're basically suggesting that only the party could in fact benefit from the relief in a case. So if you think about the Missouri case, and this is one of the arguments the Attorney General is making, that is whether or not the injunctive relief, this permanent injunction would only apply to the plaintiff in the case and not to every single registrant in the case. So I hope to heck the Eighth Circuit does not think that this applies to our situation. By the way, in Trump versus CASA, it's early in the case, whereas compared to in the case of Missouri, we've already had our trial. We've already held it. You know, the trial's been held, evidence taken, the judge made his ruling. The trial court judge made his ruling. So I think that we can distinguish between what happened in Trump versus CASA and the Missouri Halloween case. But that's really, I think, you know, where the battle line's going to be, quite frankly, during the oral argument on September 16th. Of course, this Attorney General of Missouri, as soon as Trump versus CASA was decided, they sent a notice into the court saying, oh, court, listen, you know, pay attention to this. The U.S. Supreme Court just ruled in this case, Trump versus CASA. And they talked about injunctive relief being limited only to the parties. Again, I don't think that should be a universal ruling, but we shall see what the Eighth Circuit rules. And we're watching very closely some of the other decisions. And in fact, we are. So because of Trump versus CASA, though, and let's just go beyond the Missouri Halloween case, because of that decision, we think that we're going to have to file more, we're going to have to start filing class action lawsuits. Because if in fact you want a court's ruling to apply to everybody, like in the state of Missouri, state of California, how about nationwide, like a SORNA challenge, right? And we'll talk about that case shortly here. But in those situations, are the only people who are going to benefit from a judge's decision going to be the plaintiffs in the lawsuit? It hasn't been that way for a long time, folks. I just want you to know. And so that, to me as an attorney, is a really troubling situation. So nothing for us to do right now except to watch. Ellie, I think you brought to my attention, I see that you're on here. Didn't you bring to my attention a case that was decided after Trump versus CASA where they had a different opinion?
Yes, it was, I believe, an opinion by the Ninth Circuit. And it was involving a universal injunction that they said the universal injunction was okay because the issue was a constitutional right. Apparently, CASA versus Trump is some type of order that was appealed, an executive order. I'll look for the case while we're on the meeting.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So, folks, the reason I asked Ellie to mention that is, now we're looking for how other courts are interpreting the Supreme Court decision. And I know maybe can be confusing and you're wondering, well, the U.S. Supreme Court, aren't they the highest court in the land? Yes, they are. But then the question is, how are you going to apply, how's that decision going to be applied in other cases? And I've already mentioned, some differences with the Missouri case because the whole trial has already been completed and the judge issued this permanent statewide injunction after the trial. So hopefully that's enough to distinguish it, but we don't know. And thanks, Roger. Roger's doing a really good job today putting links in the chat room if you want to go and look at the articles, which indeed are in fact on the Axel website. So so why don't I just go ahead and talk about the SORNA litigation case? I mean, these all are kind of like related. I feel like we're I don't know, a daisy chain here or something like that. And a chain reaction, perhaps, is a better way to describe it. So the SORNA litigation, oh my goodness, this has been pending. You know what? I don't even know which has been pending longer, the SORNA case or our Halloween case. But both of them have been pending for quite some time. And not for lack of action, but because, it just takes time to get through a court. So I hope you all remember that the federal government issued SORNA regulations. And when they issued these regulations, they were so bold as to say this applies to everybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense. And we don't think that's true. And by the way, Pacific Legal Foundation is a litigator in this case. Axalt is not. Axalt is a plaintiff in the case. And we do have some individuals who are also plaintiffs in the case. It's just a huge, huge issue. Just as a bit of background, the federal government has been trying for absolute years to get state governments to comply with, become SORNA compliant state. And guess what? Only one third of the states have said yes. Two thirds of the states, including California, have said, no, thank you. We're not interested in becoming a SORNA compliant state. So what the federal government did in these regulations, I think, is they leapfrogged the state governments. And they're like, we don't care, state governments, what you think about this. We're just going to go ahead now and reach out to the individual. And we're going to tell the individuals that they're subject to SORNA, even if the state government is not SORNA compliant. So it's a big deal. And SORNA compliance, it hurts most people because there are so many stringent requirements. I mean, you have to give, your internet identifiers. You have to basically tell the federal government every darn thing. I know somebody was convicted because he failed to give them the license plate, or I don't know, something about there was a trailer, but it was like an old dilapidated trailer that sometimes he put junk in and pulled behind his pickup truck. And he didn't reveal that because he forgot, I think, that was even there, that he owned it. So this is this kind of stuff. And also, I think much more difficult is it does say that some people would have to register more than once a year. And for states like California that have only annual registration for most registrants, that could be devastating. And I mean, some people, instead, if SORNA regulations were to apply to them here in California, instead of registering once a year, they would register four times a year. And think about it. I mean, as bad it is to register once a year, and I know for a lot of people that really puts a damper on their birthday celebrations, but the fact is, if you had to go in and register four times a year, and oh, by the way, what happens when you go to your local office to register and they won't register you because they say, correctly, that state law only requires registration once a year. So hopefully this case is going to clear things up. There is a preliminary injunction that's been issued in this case, but it only applies to the state of California. This judge is brave, but I guess he's not brave enough to issue a national preliminary injunction. I wish he would have, but I understand why not. I guess. Maybe he has higher aspirations or something. Maybe he wants to become a Supreme Court justice. I don't know what it is. And I don't mean to disparage him at all, because I find him to be a good judge. I've appeared before him twice, and I thought that he had fair rulings. But when it comes to this, the strangest thing about him, I think, is that he keeps delaying hearing. So there was a hearing that was scheduled for this past Monday, which was August 11. And this is about the third or fourth different hearing date in a row. And then he basically decided last week that a few days before that he wasn't going to have the hearing on August 11. And so my understanding from talking to the litigating attorney is that the judge wanted the date to be August 25th, but that attorney turns out is going to be out of the country on business on the 25th. So they're still working together, off the two parties and the judge, trying to figure out what date they can have the hearing. So as far as I know, as of today, there's not a hearing date, but we will in fact report it once there is. I also have this notion, nothing more than that, right, or gut feeling, that the judge does not want a whole bunch of people who are on the registry in his courtroom. And maybe that's one reason he keeps changing the dates. Another thing is the judge knows that regardless of his decision, it's going to be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He's going to make one of the two parties unhappy, and whichever party that is, whether it's Pacific Legal Foundation or whether it's the federal government, they're going to appeal this case to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I think that that's automatic. It's certainly a big federal issue. It should be automatic. And then the question beyond that, quite frankly, looking into the future, is whether or not this case could end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's that important. And when I when I'm let me clarify a little bit more about when the government says that takes the position that everybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense is in fact subject to the SORNA regulations, they mean everybody, even people who are no longer required to register. Now think about what a mess would that would be. So I, you know, talked about people having to register four times a day instead, I'm sorry, a year instead of once a year. What if people who haven't registered for 10 years or longer, and all of a sudden they're being dragged into the registration process? So it's really an important issue that needs to be resolved in the federal courts here. Before I go on, I guess I should ask if anybody has any questions. I haven't been looking at the chat room, so maybe there is something there. But does anybody want any further detail about SORNA or the Halloween case?
Janice, this is Jay.
Yes. Hi, Jay.
I had a more technical question.
Okay.
When you publish these lovely articles,
yes, sir.
It says you can make comments afterward, but I have looked and tried to figure out how to make a comment on an article, and I cannot find any method to do that.
Okay, Jay, we are in luck because the expert in that, Roger, is on the part of this meeting. Please, Roger, answer that question.
Thank you.
The comment field is beneath each article. If you scroll down, you'll see it near the bottom, just before everybody else's comments. My phone number is on the screen. Give me a call afterward if you have problems. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Hey, Roger, I don't know if this is technically possible or not, but could you pull up the Exile website right now and show the gentleman what you're talking about?
Sure, be glad to.
That would be helpful.
We designed it so that people can look at, let me pull up one of the recent articles. We designed it so that people can easily share the website. Okay, so like here's an article. You just keep scrolling down. See, and then if we have any documents that we added, it's here so you guys can read them or download them. You just keep going down, and then it gets to the disclaimer and related posts. Keep going. Here are the requirements. I hope people actually read these. These are all based on abuses in the past people have made when making comments. I know it seems like a long list, but a lot of them have caused flame wars and bad feelings and people leaving the website forever kind of thing. Right here, there's a field here. You see that? So you put your comment there, right? And then it'll ask you for your email address. I'm the only one who sees your email address. Don't worry about it. But it does help me verify if you're a real person or not. And then you have to check the box that you're not a robot, because yes, we do have spammers. And these are the previous comments in the article. You can scroll down. Does that answer your question?
Very well. Apparently, I did not scroll down.
Cool.
And I find it amusing that robots are now used to ask me if I'm not a robot to confirm that fact. Anyway, thank you.
Jay, I agree with your sense of humor there. How do you have to prove to a robot that you're not a robot? It's like it can make you a little crazy. All right, so let's go on. I don't see any other hands up.
I have a comment, Dennis.
Oh, surely.
I have a comment in regard to your case in the Eighth Circuit.
Yes.
Up the judges during this meeting. One of the judges was appointed by George W. Bush, so he's been on the bench a long time. One person was appointed by Obama, former federal public defender.
Oh, that's
funny. The third person was appointed by the current president, whose name I shall not say. And he's a recovered alcoholic for like more than 25 years.
Well, I applaud his sobriety. I'll leave it at that. Okay.
So that's who Janice will be facing. I sent it to an email, but I always like to know who the judges are.
Absolutely. And so, I appreciate you doing that research. I hadn't done it yet. Folks, I only found out yesterday afternoon that there's a hearing on September 16th and who the judges are. So, yeah. Okay. All right. One of the things that I've talked about in the past is Section 8 housing. And so I want to bring that up one more time. I don't have anything new to say about it, but I think that there are people in this meeting that haven't joined us in the past. In fact, why don't I just ask that question right now? And if this is the first Zoom meeting, Exile Zoom meeting that you have participated in, would you be so kind as to raise your hand? Because, and Roger, I don't know if I can see all the things. things.
Yeah, if you guys hold down the Alt key and press the Y key, that raises a hand on there. It's the same as if you go to the bottom and do it. So seeing 1, 2, and one person raise their own hand, 3, and I'm just shuffling through here. It looks like hands 3.
Physically up. Well, I see 2 people who had their actual hands up and then some others. Okay, well, and the only reason I asked this question, folks, is because, and welcome, we're so glad that you're here. You know, I'm a lawyer, and you can tell I love the law, and I love to talk about these cases and what's going on in the courts. And I want you to know, though, the biggest, most important message is we're here to give you hope, okay? Our organization is here to give you hope, give you support. The reason we talk about these cases and the laws is try to keep you safe, right? And, you know, some people want to play ostrich and put their head in the sand, but that doesn't serve anybody well because it doesn't make any difference if you know about the law or not, it will still apply to you. So that old saying about the ignorance of the law is no excuse is absolute. And the courts don't care if you know about the law or not. But if you violate that law, guess what? They could, in fact, convict you of another sex offense. And so I'll be talking shortly about traveling domestically and overseas and doing so. I encourage you to do it. I think it's good for your soul. I know it's good for my soul to get out of town and go see some new sites. But when you're on the registry, you need to be careful when you do it to end up so that you do not end up back in custody. Okay. But again, we're here to give you hope. We're here to support you. And just know we love you and we're a judgment-free zone. So, okay. So moving on to, what did I say I was going to talk about? Section 8 housing. Okay. Section 8 housing is a federal issue. So the Department of HHS, sometimes I confuse that with the Homeland Security. No, it's housing and what, urban development. Okay. So that agency basically provides funding for Section 8 housing. And of course, they have rules, lots and lots of rules. Well, the one rule that I want to talk about today is, in fact, the rule that if you're on a life, if you're required to register for life, then you are not eligible to either obtain Section 8 housing on your own or, in fact, live in anybody else's Section 8 housing or not. I'm helping right now a married couple. He's on the registry, and they keep giving her so much grief about trying to get him to move in to live with his live with their husband, for goodness sake, right? So, but please listen carefully to what I said. If you're required to register for life, you are not eligible to obtain Section 8 housing or to live in anybody else's Section 8 housing. In California, there's been a big change in that people are assigned to tiers now. And if you're assigned to either Tier 1 or Tier 2, guess what? You're no longer required to register for life. And therefore, it is my strong belief that you are therefore eligible for Section 8 housing. And so I have written letters and letters that have resulted in a person getting Section 8 housing, even though in the past they have been denied Section 8 housing. So it's very, somewhat fact dependent. People who are in other states, I'm happy to write letters for you as well. Basically interpreting the law, this federal law about who is eligible and who is not eligible for Section 8 housing. And member of society, you've got your hand up. Lisa, you have a question or a comment, sir, or ma'am?
Yes, hi. I am dealing with that problem or issue right as we speak. I have an advocate that sends me housing opportunities, and there's one for the Section 8. I let my advocate know my situation in the beginning, and I said I'm not required to register in another year. I've got to do all the filing and all this, and she said that should be no problem. So just to let you know that there's other people that are dealing with that. And yeah, so hopefully that'll work.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for that comment. I appreciate it. Okay. So I mentioned very briefly travel. So let's go ahead and talk about travel right now. There's domestic travel and there's overseas travel, and they are vastly different, folks. So remember, we're trying to help you navigate successfully through laws and regulations. So when it comes to traveling within the United States, it's very complicated. All right. And the reason it's complicated is because when you go visit other states, then you, in fact, you have to abide by their laws. And the reason I talk about this over and over again is, in fact, that we want you to avoid registering in any additional states. So maybe you have to register in the state where you currently reside, and that's bad enough. But trust me, if you register in some of these other states, number one, There are some states like Florida and New York where once you get on the registry, they will never let you go. Okay. They don't care that you don't live there. They don't care that you were only there for a week to go to Disney. They don't care. Okay. They will, in fact, keep you on the registry for the rest of your life. And for some people, they keep you on their registry even when you're dead. In this case, there was a case, a challenge, a legal challenge about that, about the Florida registry. And guess what? The family lost, and that person was kept on the registry even though they were deceased. So this is how crazy it can be, right? And we're trying to help you navigate successfully. Another reason this is important has to do with the International Megan's Law. And International Megan's Law, if you are, you know, able to get off the registry in the state where you currently reside, so you don't have to register in the state where you reside, but you're still on the registry of another state like Florida or New York, guess what? Then you will be considered a covered sex offender and have to have a unique identifier added to your passport. So I'm going to talk about both of those things slightly in a few minutes, but right now I really want to talk about domestic travel. So why, you know, again, we're sharing this information with you so that you can avoid registering in any other states, including Florida and New York, but certainly not limited to Florida and New York. So each of the states has a requirement, about when you have to register. So let's talk about both ends of the spectrum. Nevada and Florida both require registration after 48 hours. So if you stay there more than 48 hours, you must register in those states. And think about it. If you're only going to be there for 3 days and you have to register, well, you probably need to add a fourth day to your travel because, in fact, it's going to take that long for you to get ready. So there's the difficulty, there's the time consumed that it takes, etc. You've got that. Again, that's 48 hours. On the other end of the spectrum is, in fact, we're talking about states now, is Hawaii. So Hawaii allows registrants to come visit for 10 days before you have to register. Hawaii is like only a few states in that also there's an annual limit. So they do not allow registrants to visit for more than 30 days on a calendar year. And again, 10 days for each visit before you have to register there. So I hope that makes sense to you. And then there are all kinds of other states in between the number of days. A lot, 3 days seems to be really common, but the folks, when you're looking at this, sometimes to understand is sometimes it's 3 calendar days. Sometimes it's 3 business days. Do they count the day that you arrive? Do they count the day that you depart? You need to know all these details, again, in order to avoid triggering a registration requirement. So I know there's a bunch of chat going on over there, so I'm going to try to avoid it. And somebody said Rhode Island is 24 hours. Yes. Okay. 24 hours. The good news about Rhode Island is, and I used to mention them all the time, but I don't mention them so much anymore because it's such a small state. And so folks, if you're going to go visit, you know, Aunt Martha for Thanksgiving and she lives in Rhode Island, it's really easy to stay in another state. So stay in a hotel in another state other than staying at Aunt Martha's house. Make your excuses, whatever you have to do. Oh, sorry, Aunt Martha, you don't have a swimming pool in your backyard or a hot tub or something, you know, or I need a vegan meal. I don't know what it is. You can make up your excuses and stuff to go stay in a hotel. But the fact is, it's easy to avoid that in Rhode Island because there are states around it that have much longer, allow you to stay to visit much longer without triggering the registration requirement. Okay, somebody asked, what about the states that say within 5 days of if you stay 10 days? I'm not sure what that means, but I'm going to guess. And then Marina, you can correct me if I'm wrong. So if in fact a state would have a requirement about if you stay for 10 days, you have to register within 5 days, then I'm not sure what that means. Never mind. I'm going to stop guessing, Marina. Just if you would add some more information in chat or go ahead and raise your hand. It's my understanding that people convicted of misdemeanor offenses are never required to register in Nevada or California. Is that correct? No, that is not correct in California. Lots of people in California were convicted of misdemeanor sex offenses and they're registering. So why don't we talk about a couple of them, Ellie? The one that really roused me is 647.6. That's Penal Code Section 647.6. It's a misdemeanor offense. The name of the offense is to annoy, and then it says, or molest a child. If it only said annoy a child, I'd be okay with that. But because it also adds the word molest, people who read that are often confused and they think it's a hands-on offense. Trust me, if you inappropriately touched a minor, you would never be convicted of 647.6. This is a non-contact offense. And here is an example, prime example of somebody. I had a client who was convicted of Penal Code Section 647.6, and this is what he did. He was sitting in his car at a red light. There's a crosswalk in front of his car. And he stopped appropriately in his car, and he wasn't, you know, he did everything right until he rolled down the window of his car when two teenage girls walked in front of his car and yelled out, "Hey, baby, got great tits." Okay, is that rude? Yes. But should somebody have to be required to register? At that point in time, it was for life because he said, made this rude comment. No. I don't think anybody should be required to register, but not somebody who makes a rude comment like that. So anyway, plenty of people are required to register in California if they've been convicted of a misdemeanor. Another one, I don't know if Ellie, if you want to talk about this one or not, and that has to do with, I'm thinking of indecent exposure or public indecency.
Right. I'm blanking on the penal code, but also sexual battery, I believe, is a misdemeanor, and that requires registration. But indecent exposure is a misdemeanor, and that would involve somebody urinating in public. I had a client who was on the registry for skinny dipping in a motel pool. That might be considered, you know, nudity in public. Sexual battery does not have to involve skin to skin contact. It could be where somebody might touch somebody over his or her clothing. So those are usually misdemeanors, and those misdemeanors have a 10-year registration. Janice, there's an interesting question in the chat. If somebody, and I'm not 100% certain on this, but if somebody has a registrable offense in California and the registration period has ended, so they petition the court, court terminates registration, what effect does that have on another state? Say, like,
well, yeah, I've been trying to avoid that question, but so why don't we just pause and I will answer it or address it in a minute. I think you have probably have something to say about it as well. So because I think people need to understand, let's just say people, if you're required to register here in California and you visit another state, would you in fact, you know, then you have to be very mindful of the registration laws in these other states that you, where you visit. Okay, just be mindful. And if you can, avoid triggering a registration requirement. And I was looking for public indecency penal code section too, but anyway, Ellie described it beautifully about what it is and how you can end up. I mean, I just remember in the good old days, right? when I was in high school and college, and for some reason, people thought streaking was just a really good idea, running through the campus without any clothes. Well, that indeed is public indecency, and those people today could in fact be convicted of a sex offense and be required to register. So somebody had their hand up and then the hand disappeared. So I don't know, Ellie, maybe you did in fact raise that question, and maybe it had to do with the with people who are no longer required to register. So folks, that is even more complicated. So as I said, it's complicated. If in fact you're already required to register in a state and then you go visit another state, it's even more complicated if you're no longer required to register in a in the home state and you're visiting other states. So I guess the bottom line is this, just because you're no longer required to register in your home state does not mean you don't have to register when you visit another state. I am so sad to tell you that, but you need to know, okay? Because some states say, if a person has ever been required to register and you come visit our state, then you have to register if you trigger the registration requirement. So usually when people ask me about this, I said, look, there's an easy and cheap way to do this, and there's an expensive way to do it. And let me tell you what I mean by that. So the easier way to do it, the cheaper way to do this, is just act as if you're still required to register. Look at the laws in the states that you're going to visit and think, well, if I was still on the registry in my state, would I be required to register in the state? And then basically avoid the registration requirement. That's easier than the other option that I see, which is you contact an attorney in every state you're going to visit and have that attorney basically do the research for you. I mean, because that's what it is. That's going to take time and it's going to take money. So it's up to you how you want to proceed. And trust me, I've got plenty of phone calls from people who say, hey, I just want to go to Las Vegas. I want to be there, you know, for a week. Who is going to know that I'm there? How is anybody going to find out that I'm there? And it doesn't have to be Las Vegas. It can be other locations as well. How about this? You're in a traffic accident, right? If you're in a traffic accident, my goodness. And you know, you end up, it's not your fault or anything, but you end up in the emergency room and then they start asking you questions, right? And guess what? They're going to run your background. They're going to find out you're on the registry, or they could. And then they're like, oh, and how long have you been here? And if you've been there for 5 days, trust me, they're going to know the registration requirement is 48 hours. So this is the kind of stuff, folks, that you want to avoid if you can. Because if you get it wrong, guess what? You too could be charged with and convicted of a sex offense, and that sex offense would be failure to register. I'm sorry, failure to register is not a sex, but it is and could be a felony or it could be a misdemeanor, depending on circumstances. So if you want, there's information, by the way, on the AXLAW website. And Roger, maybe you could put in the chat room a link to that too. We have information. We did not collect this information. Somebody else did, but we think that it's mostly accurate. And so we put it there as a starting point. Okay. Okay, so that you can, in fact, go to the state laws yourself and figure out whether or not you what the registration requirements are in the state that you're visiting. You know, when I mentioned that the more expensive way that takes more time and more money, it might be worth it. Like if you're going to go to your grandparents' house and you know they live in a certain state and you go there, you know, on a regular basis, then you know at that point in time, maybe it does make sense to hire an attorney to figure it out for yourself, whether or not you're going to trigger the registration requirement. So thank you, Roger, for putting that in there. And somebody just mentioned about automatic license plate readers. I mean, that is certainly some way that people can find out if you're visiting from another state and could, you know, then track you down. Because of course, you know, if you're on the registry, you have to report your vehicles, right? And it's possible in reporting your vehicles, then in fact, somebody gets your license plate number and goes, oh, look at this. We have a person who's required to register visiting us. I wonder how long they've been here. You know, and another possibility too, like, as I said, where you might be involved in a traffic accident, heaven forbid, you know, they look at things like if you flew into the state, when did you fly in? And oh, by the way, when is your return ticket or how long have you been there to flew in? So those are some of the ways that people can get caught up here in this mess that is registering in another state that you visit. So I don't see any other hands up, but let me take a quick look at the chat. I see there's two new messages. Yeah. My husband says, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean someone isn't out to get me. I've heard that saying before. I'm an optimist. I don't live my life that way, but I understand that point of view. And yeah, and nothing wrong with an overabundance of caution. I that too. And folks, think about it. We take risk every single day, right? I mean, I get in my car and I drive off. I drive places and I do my best to be a safe driver. And sometimes I think other people around me are not so safe. But the fact is that, you know, it's taking a risk when you get in your car. It's taking a risk walking across the street. It's taking a risk, I don't know, taking a bubble bath. You know, there's risk that we all take every day. And so, you know, when I make certain recommendations, it has to do with risk. And if you're like, oh, I don't care. I'm going to go to Las Vegas for a week and probably I won't be in a car accident and I won't get caught. Okay, that's the risk. You know, if you're willing to take that risk, take it. But you're the one who's going to end up in being charged with and possibly and convicted of a failure to register, and you could end up back in custody. All right, Armando, you have your hand up, sir. Please ask a question or make a comment.
Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Have you already explained about the ongoing situation between the Snorna and the Pacific Foundation case?
Yes, I did. So perhaps you can listen to the recording, sir.
Okay, and I have one more question.
Okay.
So I'm in a situation where my resident agent would not give me my police report, even though my case was dismissed and expunged. But I'm still, I just wonder how can I attain if the police won't give me my police report.
That's something maybe Ellie has a more complete answer than I do. Ellie?
Yeah. Ask your lawyer. Did you have a lawyer?
I used to, but not anymore. I had a defender when I was like going through the reduction, the dismissal, but I don't have no attorney, not even a public defender.
Who represented you for the initial conviction?
It was a private lawyer.
Well, contact the private lawyer. That file is yours, and ask that private lawyer for the file, and you should include the arrest report, and that attorney should give it to you.
Yeah, but the problem is that I don't have the number or the information.
Do you have a name of the person?
Is the guy text you in the chat, or
what state are you in? What state are you in? Yeah, put it in the chat. Yeah. All right. Put it in the chat. I'll respond.
Thank you, Ellie. Okay, so we've been talking about domestic travel. That means travel within the United States. Let's talk about overseas travel. Overseas travel, to me, is simpler, but it can be, it's not necessarily good news, depending on what state you want to go to, okay? So when it comes to traveling overseas, if you're still required to register, then you have to give a 21-day notice to your local law enforcement office, basically saying, hey, I'm planning to travel overseas. By the way, the law says 21 days. I usually recommend people get that information within 30 days. Why? Because the government can't always count properly. But you do what you want to do. Remember, it's all about how much risk you're willing to take. Go ahead and notify them in writing. Don't just pick up the phone and call somebody and think that you've given notice. You must do this in writing. And in fact, the California Department of Justice has developed a form, which I believe is linked on our website, Roger, a form that you can fill out and take to local law enforcement. Then what happens after that is local law enforcement sends that information to the federal government. But guess what? The federal government will not accept that information directly from you, nor will they accept it even from your attorney. I tried early on. They said no. So you have to take this information to your local law enforcement office where you register, and then they take it from there. And remember, it's at least 21-day notice before you're going to depart. What kind of information do they need to know? They need to know, assume that you're flying somewhere. I guess it could be a cruise. So when you're going to depart, I mean, we're talking about date, time, location, if it's a flight number. I guess if you're going to go on a cruise, you would mention the cruise line or some. There's got to be some identifying information there. But the thing is, you don't have to give them a complete itinerary. You don't have to say, oh, and then I'm going to go to, I'm going to start in beautiful Italy and see the Colosseum in Rome, and then I'm going to go to Spain, I'm going to go to Barcelona, and then I think I'll go to France to see the Eiffel Tower. No, you don't have to do any of that. What you have to do is just say, I am leaving the country on this day, at this time on flight X, Y, and Z, and then I'm coming home on this date, at this time, this and this flight. Okay, that's the information you have to give them. Again, you do not have to give them your complete itinerary, and I would recommend you not give them your complete itinerary. It's no darn business of their own. Okay, so what happens after local law enforcement sends the information to the federal government? Well, our federal government will send a notice to the country to which you are traveling saying, this person is coming. This person was convicted of a sex offense, and this person is coming to visit your country. I don't like that notice. It's so vague and misleading because you might have been convicted more than 30 years ago. It doesn't say that. It doesn't even say what sex offense you were convicted of. So if you were convicted, for example, of public indecency, or if you were convicted of rape or something in between, it doesn't say that. This person was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor or a sex offense. Okay, so that's a 21-day notice part of that. The second part of it has to do with your passport. But before I go there, I see Rafael's got his hand up. So Rafael, do you have a question or comment?
Yes. What if you want to depart internationally indefinitely?
Well, I think if you're planning to leave permanently, I think that's what you would have to say, that you're leaving permanently. Is that what you mean?
Well, I mean, permanently, I think they take you off the registry. But indefinitely is you still in the registry. You just have to let them know that you're back and continue registering. But I have no idea. I do need to come back.
Yes.
And I don't want to give up my U.S. citizenship, but I do want to have that freedom to come back when I need to.
I don't know the answer to your question, quite frankly, because I think what you would be doing then, you'd be buying a one-way ticket, yes?
Yeah, well, when you file that form, they ask you when are you coming back, and they want you to give the return information.
Right.
So if you want to say indefinitely, you don't know when, but you will.
I guess you just share that information with them and see what they have to say. But most of the time, they want to know when you're departing and when you're returning. I mean, the other possibility is, I don't know, if this makes sense financially, that you would go ahead and buy a return ticket and say, you say, hey, you know, I'm coming back in 60 days or something. I plan to come back in 60 days. And then that doesn't obligate you to actually come back in 60 days.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Gus, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I'm also kind of facing the same situation. And I guess I just wanted to piggyback on that. So imagining a scenario where I also don't want to lose the ability to potentially come back. Although in the state where I'm at, the moment that I leave my home, I lose homestead exemption, and meaning I can't come back to this home. So if I were to come back, I would want to come back to a different state than the one I'm in, because I'm in one of the worst ones that is there. But I guess my question is, so I will give the itinerary saying, listen, I'm just leaving the country. I don't know when I'm going to come back. And based on what you're saying, then they're going to give me whatever their answer is in reference to that. I imagine that you're going to, that I will provide an address, and that will be the address that they will put as a temporary address on the registry. And so I'm going to be at a hotel. So that's not important to me. But what happens? So if I get there and, you know, I'm going to one specific country, I do plan to go to the other country. So I know that I don't have to give an itinerary for the other countries. But what happens, for example, if I change my phone number? And so it's supposedly, if you're still registered in Florida, you're supposed to update when you change your phone number, your emails and all that. Am I still required to do that if I am no longer in here and I am now under the laws of whatever other country I go to? Do I still need to continuously report to my home base?
No, I don't think that you do. I think, again, you know, remember, as long as you do the 21-day notice requirement, then you say, I'm leaving the United States on this day at this time from this location. Oh, by the way, here's my flight number. And then you go to that other country and you're telling them, I guess you're in your scenario, the scenario you described, you have a hotel reservation, so you're going to go to this hotel. You don't know what you're going to do after that, so there's nothing else that you can actually share with them, right? But I really don't know, and this is, I swear, the first time it's come up, and even though we've been talking about this issue for years of overseas travel, whether or not, whether, you know, what, how they would react if you didn't give them a return date, return information.
Right, and I think your suggestion is a good one. I mean, I'm going to tell them I don't know when I'm coming back, and they'll make whatever determination they need to make in terms of how they view that. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm not absconding. I'm giving the 21. I'm giving a 30 day notice. You know, your suggestions are really key on that. I guess my question is, so now in the state that I'm in, the moment that you use a new email, the moment that you use a new phone number, you're supposed to update that. My question is, if I am no longer here. And I mean, you know, ideally, I think I'm just going to reside outside the U.S. for the rest of my life. But who knows? Maybe I might want to come back and visit. But while I'm residing the rest of my life outside the U.S., am I still required to continuously update my state information?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
No. When you're overseas, you're overseas. So, and you know, again, and somebody said something, they had a different experience in their jurisdiction. The jurisdiction would not let them just say, well, this is when I'm departing and this is what I'm returning, but wanted the information in between. That's the first time I've heard of that. I'm not sure that they can actually demand that. They can ask for it. But if somebody told me about that in California, I'd be writing a letter to the jurisdiction. But my understanding, the federal requirement is only I am departing the United States on this date at this time from this location and the flight number. And oh, by the way, America, it's a plan. And then, oh, by the way, I'm returning to the United States on this day at this time, you know, from this location and the flight number. And I think that's all that you owe them. And what you do in between is, quite frankly, none of their business.
Right. I guess the part that I'm a little worried about is if I tell them I'm coming back on a specific date, mm-hmm. and I don't come back, then now all of a sudden there's a paper trail of a misleading information. So, you know, I'm going to have a conversation with my registry this week. About this, and yeah. I'll update you and let you know what it is that they say.
Okay, I'd appreciate that, Gus. I just don't know. Ellie, have you had any experience with this?
No.
Yeah, I swear nobody's even asked me this question before. It's like, that's a really novel question, and I'd really like to know the answer. So Gus, if you ask your registration officer about this and that you get an answer, please let us know. And by the way, that might not be the final answer anyway, because there's always the federal government, and they may have a different interpretation. Rafael, you have your hand up again?
Yes, I have a dual citizenship, so I guess I can tell them that I'm going back to my country, but I do plan to go back at some point. So that's the difference between me and the other gentleman.
I don't know if that makes a difference. I mean, to our government, why would they care whether, you know, if you're going... I mean, I guess what would be the benefit of telling them that you want to keep open that you're coming to the United States? I mean, if you have two passports, I mean, as a U.S. citizen, the U.S. cannot deny you entry. Did you know that?
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay. No, I understand. I know that.
Okay.
And Janice, I'm sorry, just a quick follow-up.
Sure.
So you mentioned I'm clearing it with my state, but you mentioned that that might not be the final answer because the federal government might have other requirements. And how would I find out about that?
Well, they'll let you know. They will let you know. So let me move on to the next part, because I think maybe these things are interrelated. The next part has to do with passports, okay? So if you're required to register and your victim was a minor, your passport and any newly issued passport must include the unique identifier, a unique identifier. Okay, no, I should say V because there's only one. Okay, so think about that. You've been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you're currently required to register. So when we're talking about before about domestic travel and trying to avoid registering in multiple states, well, this is one of the main reasons why, because we don't want you to have a unique identifier on your passport if it can be avoided. I said if it can be avoided. Okay, but again, if you're convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you're required to register in one or more states, then you must have a unique identifier added to your newly issued passport. Okay, what about if you have an existing passport? The existing passport may not have the unique identifier on it, right? And if it doesn't have the unique identifier on it, this is the issue, because the State Department can revoke your passport at any time if it does not have a unique identifier. I hate the unique identifier. I fought very hard in court to get the stop before I even started, and I was not successful. Okay, so they thought it was just fine to add language to a citizen's passports, basically saying this person was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And this is how terrible it is. I agree. It's a scarlet letter. We talked many times about being on the registry and how that's a scarlet letter. This is literally a scarlet letter. Okay, because countries to which you are traveling are going to see this notice, and it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, this person was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Again, it doesn't say how long ago. It doesn't say what kind of sex offense. It could have been a non-contact, non-violent offense. Oh, by the way, it might not even be a crime in the country to which you're traveling, but they don't get any details. So many people, of course, assume the worst. And the worst is, of course, you know, you've raped 10 kids. So, which would be terrible. So the fact is that the unique identifier and the lack of it on your passport can cause you problems. Having it on there so far has not caused problems, to my great shock. Right. So the shock. And so is that a definite conjunction for the unique identifier? If and both must be true to trigger the mark. Yes, Greg. Yes. Okay. I said if you're required to if your offense involved a minor and you are required to register in at least one state, then yes, you have to have a unique identifier added to your passport at some time. Okay. And again, if you don't have it added to your passport, guess what? Then the State Department can revoke your passport at any time. And I do mean literally. So let me tell you a terrible story. It's an outlier. As far as I know, it's only happened this one time, but here goes. And the person was my client, and he consulted with me before he left to go to Europe. So he's on the plane with his wife. Their bags have been checked, you know, on the flight, all this other stuff, right? And they're sitting in their seats on the plane that's going to be taking off soon. He gets a tap on the shoulder that says, hey, you have to get off this flight. You don't have a passport. And he said, what do you mean? I have my passport right here. Takes it out of his pocket. And the next thing he knows, the person who happened to be an employee of the Department of Homeland Security took his passport right then and there and said, no, you don't have a passport. Your passport's been revoked. Okay. He and his wife got off that plane. They did not travel to Europe. I mean, this is how terrible it can be. So if you don't have a unique identifier on your passport, so that's why, as much as I hate the unique identifier, If you want to travel overseas, then, and again, you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you're required to register, you're traveling at risk. Gus, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I just wanted to share. I just recently got my passport. It had expired. And the way that they're doing it is that you pay for the passport and they'll send you a passport without the identifier. They're sending it without the identifier. So in my state, if you have a passport, you're supposed to report it. So I went to the registry and the guy didn't even know why I was showing him my passport to begin with. But I go, look, I'm required to show you my passport. So then he grabs it, he talks to somebody else, comes back, and he inputs my passport number into the database. Now, I don't know if that database is being shared with, the passport office or whatever department handles that. But then what I did then is I sent the passport back and I said, listen, you know, I with a letter, Roger was helpful in assisting me with this. And I sent the passport back with the letter. And then they sent me a passport with my identifier. I went back to the registry and I told the guy, he goes, but you already gave me a passport. I go, yeah, but remember I told you it has to have an identifier. He didn't even look for the identifier, although it's right there on that page, but he just, again, re-entered the information in the database. I say this just in case somebody renews their passport, gets it without the identifier and thinks about using it. I think I would strongly encourage against that because of what you just mentioned. The other thing too is then they actually sent me the original passport back. So now I have two passports. I have one with the identifier and one without. And I will never use the one without. But I just wanted to share what my experience has been in case somebody's looking to get their passport.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Gus. Folks, this is one of those many times when the federal government doesn't make sense. And what I mean by that, the International Megan's Law says that the State Department must add a unique identifier to newly issued passports. Not may, but must. Okay. But as Gus just said, sometimes it doesn't happen. So the question then is who bears the burden of getting this corrected? And right now, the State Department has shifted the burden to the individual, which I think is wrong. Okay. I think the State Department, if they've made a mess, then they should be cleaning it up. Or you should just not have to have a unique identifier added to your passport. But that's not, you know, if you don't have the unique identifier and you qualify as, and this is a term under the International Megan's Law, covered sex offender. If you are a covered sex offender, and again, that means convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and we're not talking about a hands-on offense here, folks. People who get convicted of possessing child pornography, that is an offense involving a minor. Think of it. We're a child pornography. Anyway, so that, and you're required to register, then in fact, you need to have this unique identifier added. So what the State Department is saying now is they want you to write a letter that goes with your passport application where you ask that the unique identifier be added to your passport. I just think that's egregious because who the heck wants that identifier on their passport, right? Who wants the scarlet letter? But again, if you don't have it, then you're traveling at risk. So Gus could have avoided his situation if he had known to put this letter along, sent the letter along with the application asking for a new passport. There's also a phone number that you can call, and I'm pretty sure that information is available on our Excel website. There's a phone number you can call at the State Department. Supposedly, that's what they say on their own website. If you get a passport and it doesn't have the unique identifier, you can call this phone number. And Gus, I don't know if that's the number you called or not, but I'm glad that you eventually got some assistance here. But folks, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, I had to pay for the whole process all over again and just include that letter. And then that solved it. And just so that's it for me. But Rafael, I'm going to put my email on the chat. I'd love to talk to you because I think we're having similar situations and I'd love to, talk to you about that.
And we encourage you to do that. Thank you, Gus. Okay. So why is it important to, in fact, abide by the International Megan's Law? This is it. Remember, we were talking about risk earlier and taking risk and how much risk are you willing to take? Are you comfortable taking? The ultimate penalty for violating the International Megan's Law is 10 years in federal prison. 10 years in federal prison. So when you're doing your risk benefit analysis, please remember 10 years in federal prison. I don't know about you, but I don't want to spend 10 years in federal prison for any reason, and certainly not for this reason. So, but you can make your own decisions here and decide how much risk you want to take. Okay. So, We talked a lot now about federal laws and things that apply to people in most states, if not every state. And I'm going to shift here and start talking about California law. Before I do that, I want to remind people that, in fact, our AXAL is a nonprofit organization, and the amount of work that we can do depends entirely upon the amount of donations we've received. So please, please consider strongly making a donation to AXAL. It's easy to do by going to our website. There's actually a donate button. You can press a donate button, and they will take PayPal or they'll take credit cards and things like that. And every single donation is extremely helpful, again, to the cause and to allow us to do the things that need to be done. Okay, Roger just put it in the chat. You can just basically click on that link right there, and it'll take you right to the donate button. So some people, by the way, give an amount every month. You can sign up for a monthly donation, or you can sign up for a one-time donation. But please understand that everything that we do depends on those donations. All right, so somebody just asked, it's early, but do you expect to hold the D.C. rally and lobby day? Yes, we will do lobby day here in Sacramento. There's no doubt about it, in March. The question is whether or not we're going to go to D.C., and we don't know yet. We just don't know yet. I mean, right now, Washington, D.C. is under the control of the federal government, right? They basically kicked out the D.C. police force or whatever they're doing with them, muzzling them or something. So we don't know yet if we think that it's safe to go to Washington, D.C. I'm going to go if there's any doubt that it might be safe. I'm going to go. So I think that we will have a vigil in March. The question is whether or not there'll be a conference, really. So some of us are going to show up no matter what. I know Roger and I have already pledged to each other that we're going to Washington, D.C. for the vigil. And hopefully we'll be able to put a conference on, too. But I don't know about that. So thanks for asking. Okay. So let's talk about California. We filed a lawsuit recently, about 2 weeks ago now, on behalf of people, females, who are on the registry in California. So our Department of Corrections, in their infinite wisdom, and yes, I'm being sarcastic, on their infinite wisdom, they decided to create a tool to that's supposedly going to let people know whether or not a woman is likely to reoffend. Okay, this applies to female registrants and whether or not they're likely to reoffend. They created a tool. They call it FSORA. Sometimes I just call it FSORA. Thank you, Armin. I'm so glad you're coming to D.C. Thank you. So CDCR, and I don't know if every state is the same way, but our Department of Corrections just sometimes plays cowboy and they think they're on the Wild West and they can do anything they want. We have a different opinion of that. So we sued the CDCR because we said, look, this tool that you're using to determine a female registrant's likelihood of reoffense is bitch of baloney. I mean, it's like they came in a Cracker Jack box, if you all remember what Cracker Jack is. And those little toys that you would get, or it's just utter nonsense. So, and the reason that we're filing the challenge really is because so many women now are being designated as high risk offenders when nobody knows what the risk of reoffense is. Nobody. It's unknowable. Okay. Because so few women are on the registry nationwide that they can't even come up with a valid tool or a tool that's been validated. So CDCR just said, we don't care. That's not validated. We're going to use this anyway. So we have filed that lawsuit against on behalf of registrants, female registrants who are being basically it's determined or identified as a high-risk offender using something that's garbage, a garbage tool. Kind of reminds me of polygraph exams, folks. So anyway, the FSORA and polygraph exams, you can put those in the same category in your brain. I do anyway. Okay. And so because in California, too, if in fact you are considered a high-risk offender, then and on parole, I do need to add that qualifier. If you're a female who's on the registry and on parole and you're considered high risk, you cannot live within half a mile of a school. And so that eliminates a whole lot of places where people can live. I mean, so many places a person can live. And certainly in densely populated locations like Los Angeles and San Francisco, I think San Diego now as well, there are very few housing units available that are not, that are farther away from a school, K-12 school, than half a mile. So we think this is an important lawsuit, and that's why we filed it. So this is the kind of things we do when you make a donation. We have resources to do this. Moving on, I wanted to talk about a future lawsuit. This is something that's on my list of lawsuits to be filed, and it has to do, again, with registrants, not just females, but male and female registrants who are on parole and currently being required to undergo treatment. By the way, in California, we have over 7,000 people in that category. Over 7,000 men and women required to register and on parole. And the thing is, we sued Department of Corrections at this point in time because, in fact, they had a policy, an unofficial policy that they didn't even bother to write down, that basically said that they would, in fact, require a person, again, a registrant on parole, to undergo treatment the entire time they're on parole. So this was, it is adversely affecting people who are, who have jobs, right? And it's like, I had one client who was a truck driver, and he was supposed to be, you know, going through treatment every Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Well, the fact is, he was a truck driver, and it was really hard for him to be there every Wednesday at 6 o'clock. And because of that, he had to turn jobs down, and basically, you know, his income potential was limited because of that. So that's one reason. And then another is, if you're undergoing treatment, it's very unlikely that you are going to get early discharge from parole. Think about that. Okay, even though you would otherwise be eligible to for early discharge from parole, they're going to deny you early discharge because you're undergoing treatment. It's like a catch-22. So we knew that it was wrong. We sued the Department of Corrections, and they wisely decided to settle the case, and they settled the case by issuing new regulations that say something different. However, unfortunately, it appears that CDCR is not, in fact, following their own regulations. So the regulations were issued last October of 2024. So it's getting close to maybe 9 months ago. And it says they have to do certain things and they're not doing it. So, in fact, we are preparing a new lawsuit now to challenge CDCR's implementation of those new regulations. So, Luis, I see that your hand is up. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, being a current parolee, I see this often, like, in our groups, and it's interesting because the group that I go to, Open Door, will say that it's parole's decision, and then they go back and say, oh, no, it's Open Door's decision on who gets off early from SO treatment. So it's really confusing. They don't even between themselves have anything set up yet, and it's frustrating because there's people that, like, you know, have done wonderful progress and should be able to, you know, be at least let go from SOT treatments, and they're not letting them. They're just keeping them there, and it's like, I think we had discussed the last meeting, it's just money, you know. It's an easy way for them to make a large figure of money with easy and revolvable people that they can bring around. And, you know, and if they, all of a sudden they say that they don't find you fit for anything, or what they call maintenance, mm-hmm. which means it would reduce the amount of numbers of meetings you go to, it sucks. It really does suck. I mean, I'm 6 months from getting off. I had a 3-year parole, which I'm happy I got 6 more months to go. But I see guys in there that have been 10 or more years, and they're like, I hate this. Just having to come to meetings and listen to the same thing over and over and over again, it's sad.
Well, it's sad, and Luis, possibly illegal, quite frankly. So, and by the way, one of the things that CDCR is not doing right now is their own regulations require them to basically hand a document to the registrant on parole after a containment meeting. So the containment meetings are supposed to be where a decision is made about whether or not further treatment is required. And then if so, what are the reasons for the continued treatment? There's a form. It's CDCR Form 3043. That form is to be given to the registrant within 30 days of the containment meeting. And folks, time after time, I'm getting calls from people saying that they didn't get that form. And the reason that the reason that is so important that they give you the form is because if they are saying something that's ridiculous, guess what? You can bring the form to me or another Ellie or another lawyer, and we can sue them. Okay, we can file a habeas petition on your behalf. So they need to be accountable. And I think I said it last month, but I think it bears repeating, which is, in fact, there's a huge profit motive here for both the treatment providers as well as CDCR. Think about it, CDCR as well. So the treatment providers are getting paid money to basically, quote, treat people who are on the registry, right? I've heard all kinds of horror stories just about that, being put in, a room and you're shown a movie that's not even relevant to anything, but you're basically expected to watch a movie. Or one person who contacted me this past week said they just gossip. They sit there and they gossip for an hour and a half. That's not supposed to be happening either. It's supposed to be treatment. But the reason that, if you're not being treated by the treatment providers, then you're not being treated by anybody. And because of that, many people are then, not put in maintenance, if folks know what that is. So after, instead of going to weekly meetings or meetings twice a week, instead of having, individual counseling, once a month, it's less often than that when you're in the maintenance phase. And so if you're in the maintenance phase and you're being considered for early discharge, it is much more likely that early discharge will be granted. But for whatever reason, I know the reason, it's profit. Okay, because of profit, the treatment providers are putting very few people into the maintenance level of their treatment programs, and that is a problem. So trust me, Luis, we will be filing another lawsuit after this one that addresses that issue. But I will tell everybody who's hearing this today and who hears the recording, just a minute, Luis, I'll certainly let you speak, that there is a complaint process that can be followed, and the Sex Offender Management Board, the Sex Offender Management Board is, in fact, the one that certifies people.
Been doing well. I just wanted to...
Okay, folks, if you're not speaking...
Everything cool, man. She sold that house in 6 days, man.
Okay, folks, if you're... Please mute yourself. You don't need to know about people's real estate.
Over there fixing her mom's house up, man. And,
all right.
I've been helping her out.
Roger, maybe you can help.
Man, to let you know that
find
I was
out who this
coming
is
in
and mute
in
them,
morning,
please.
Okay.
Roger.
And get back on schedule with everybody. And
someone named...
No keys or nothing changed or anything. I was
user. There we go. Okay. Sorry about that, folks. I'm assuming he didn't know he was on. He was unmuted. Okay. So we were talking about what, Luis? I'm serious. Remind me what we're talking about.
We were talking about the SOTs and it being just money driven.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a problem. And also one of the things, the games that they play, and I mean CDCR and the treatment providers, is they point fingers at each other saying, oh, well, it's not me that's keeping this person on treatment. It's the other person, right? Mm-hmm. Or the other organization. So we're aware of that. Oh, I know. I was also mentioning that the Sex Offender Management Board takes seriously complaints that people file with them. There is a process, a procedure. It's not that difficult. It's not that long. But if you go on the case Sex Offender Management Board website, and their website address is casomb.org, .org. Roger, maybe you can type that in for me. Then you can go there, and there is a place where you can a link that you can use for. But they identify the process for filing a complaint, as well as there's a form, of course, for filing a complaint. But I know the person who does, who leads the task force on that, and she does take it very seriously, and the whole board takes very seriously these complaints.
If I could add just one more thing. Dennis, it's interesting that you say about the maintenance phase, right? People aim to want to be on maintenance so that way they can probably get off on earlier discharge or get closer to getting off parole. The open door that I go to limits their number of people on maintenance to 13 people. Out of how many? I would say probably 300 people or more. And it's just interesting because you have to still get interviewed by the owner of Open Door, who has no licensing. He just simply fronted the money to open up the business that his wife is the one that put the license up because she's a licensed therapist.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there.
Yeah,
I don't want you to say, no, please stop talking about Open Door. okay? Because you might be defaming them, or somebody might interpret it that way.
And so, okay. So what I do know in regards to the 13 people, it's ridiculous because the way they have to follow the process of, like, if you get even close to it, you have to do 2 years first of therapy. And then if they find you someone that can qualify, then you have to get interviewed. And once you get interviewed and you get passed, then you go into maintenance. But okay. Generally, we don't last 2 years because our therapists are, you know, they get rotated so much. And then also most of the times, a lot of us are living in sober living homes. So then you get moved to another city, like here in Riverside, there's Riverside Parole, and then there's Moreno Valley. So a lot of us get moved to like another city, which causes us to then get transferred to another program. And then they restart us all over again.
Okay,
and
Luis, yeah. I'm going to cut you off because what you've described is very not completely unique. I've heard many complaints about treatment providers, including Open Door. I'd be happy to talk to you about privately, but remember this meeting's being recorded. Understood. Remember the meeting's being recorded, okay?
Okay, thank you.
So you're welcome. Roger, if you would put my contact information in the chat, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Rafael, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. Just to continue with last question on that issue that I was bringing up. So I don't want to disturb my time being in California to hopefully at some point get to the point where I can be relieved from registering. So I cannot leave indefinitely. Therefore, I want to leave it open. How long can I stay before breaking that time? If it's okay to visit a different country, how long can you stay away without breaking your term on the?
Rafael, are you asking a question in reference to the tiered registry law?
Yes.
Okay. So let me explain then. Okay. So under the tiered registry law, the time that you register, they count the amount of time you register. Okay. So I don't know where you are in your process or whatever, but let's just say if you were on tier one and you've been in the United States and you've been registering for 8 years and then you go someplace to another country, those 8 years would still be there, were you? Okay. So regardless of how long you're gone, but the time that you're gone doesn't count. Okay. So if like, and I had this in a case within the last 12 months where somebody had a 20-year requirement. He spent half of that time approximately living in Mexico. He was a law-abiding citizen there, you know, had a successful business, all these other things, and then he came back to the States. Well, you know, his 20 years had passed since he was released from custody, but he had not been in the U.S. for 20 years. He had not registered for 20 years. So again, under the scenario that I'm trying to describe with you is if you have 8 years of registration time, and I know this is a complete hypothetical, and then you go live overseas for 4 years, you come back, that's not 12 years that you've registered, it's 8 years.
Janice, I thought he meant that if he were to go to another country, say for like a year and a half, mm-hmm. and he lives in California, he missed his yearly registration date. Is that going to put him in jeopardy for missing the yearly date on his birthday that he needs to?
Well, I ask if it was in the reference to tiered registry law. Yeah, just let's ask. Rafael, were you asking about tiered registry law? Or are you asking about your annual registration? You need to unmute yourself, Rafael. We can't hear you.
Mute myself. Here we go.
There you go.
Well, I've been registering for 33 years, and I've been waiting for an offshoot to people that are to register indefinitely when that comes. So if I leave, do I lose that time of 33 years being in the registry?
No.
For my off-ramp relief?
No, I don't believe so. No.
Oh, that was my question.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, so I guess this is a good segue to talk about the tiered registry law. We, as an organization, lobbied our state legislature for almost 7 years, and we asked for a tiered registry law because up to that point in time, every person who was convicted of a sex offense in California was required to register for life, everybody. And there was a very small percentage of people who were eligible to apply for a certificate of rehabilitation. And so I don't know, Marfell, maybe that's the confusing part. If under certificate of rehabilitation law, then you would have to be in the state of California for 5 years right before you apply. Okay, but the tiered registry law doesn't have a requirement like that. Okay, but under the certificate of rehabilitation, it did. So you can leave the country for whatever amount of time, come back, you still have your 33 years of registration. Okay, all right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I could add about the certificate of rehabilitation. Each offense has a certain number of years before one can apply. And if it's a registrable offense, it might be about at least 10 years before the individual can apply for relief, 10 years from the date that he or she finished the sentence.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that clarification, Ellie. So so we ask for a law. We ask the legislature to pass a law that would be based upon current risk. So somebody like Rafael here, who's been registering for more than 30 years, you're not the same person you were when you did whatever led to your conviction. So but that's not the kind of law that we got. Instead, the law is based upon conviction offense. And then there was a political compromise that basically made things more difficult. So, and what I mean by that is we have groups of people who do not belong on the highest tier, in the highest tier. And one of those groups of people are people basically convicted of possessing child pornography. So it's a non-contact, non-violent offense, and yet they're in the same tier as a rapist. And that is a contact violent offense. Just understand there's some things that don't make sense, but fortunately, at least we have something. And about half of the people who are currently on the registry either are eligible today or may be eligible in the future to petition for removal. So folks, understand that nobody gets off the registry automatically. Everybody has to petition for removal, okay? And when can you petition? Ellie mentioned it briefly. I think you did, Ellie, a number of years, but here it goes. If you're assigned to Tier 1, that's really the golden ticket, and that means you have to register for 10 years before you're eligible to petition. If you're assigned to Tier 2, it's 20 years before you're eligible to petition. And then if you're, unfortunately, half of the group of people on the registry, if you're assigned to Tier 3, you're currently not eligible at all to petition for removal, with one small exception, which I won't mention today. Okay, so the fact is, and as Ellie said, you start counting that time, the registration time, when you're released from custody. So whether or not you were in jail or you were in prison, that starts, you start counting as far as when you were released and to that amount of years. There are a few other extenuating circumstances or factors that have to be considered. For example, if you were convicted of failure to register, there might be additional time that you have to wait, okay, but it does not take away your eligibility. You'll still be eligible, but you'll have to wait extra time. And we're talking about possibly 1 year if it's a misdemeanor and 3 years if it's a felony. Also, if you're currently on parole or probation, you're not eligible to petition for removal. What I mean by that, I mean for people who, might have been convicted of a different kind of offense, right? And they're currently on parole for that offense, then you have to wait till you're off parole to petition. And by the way, the time on parole does count toward the registration time. Marina, you have your hand up.
Yes, I have a question. You know, earlier you said a lot of people just stick their, talking about travel, stick their head in the sand like an ostrich. Well, in some of our cases, if it's an 86 conviction, it's not a matter of sticking the head in the sand. It's just that you had no idea laws could change, and it could change your requirements of what you have to do. But also, you know, Mike is registered in California, and it has been 8 months, and there's still no tier assignment. Is that a normal time waiting for a tier assignment for an 86 out-of-state conviction?
Yes. And in fact, the tiered registry law gives California DOJ up 24 months to determine a person's tier assignment.
And so we could still be looking at being in a trailer park for another 16 months then.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And by the way, if it had been a California conviction, the tier assignment probably would happen much quicker because, I mean, think about it. They already know what law it is. If it's an out-of-state conviction, then they have to go through a pretty lengthy process to determine what the equivalent offense would be here in California. So somebody with an 805 area code, you have your hand ups?
That's me, right?
Hi, yes.
Hello.
Hi.
So as far as the Tier 3 for the possession of e-charge, how's it looking as far as the state? I know they've already agree, reclassify to tier one, but the law hasn't changed. We're not, so
okay. Okay. Well, you have to be careful when you say we and they, who they and we are. So the Sex Offender Management Board has made a formal recommendation to the state legislature that people convicted of possessing child pornography belong on tier one and not tier three. That would be a huge change for thousands of people. All right. We certainly support that. In fact, we went to the Sex Offender Management Board and we asked them to join us in that effort, and they did. So you can imagine that the legislature might listen to the same board that they created, right? Because that's what happened. The legislature created the Sex Offender Management Board, right? And now they're recommending to the state legislature that people convicted of possessing child pornography be moved down from tier three, which require, you know, lifetime registration, all the way down to tier one, which would only require 10 years of registration. So the legislature, we brought that to them this year during our lobby day. We don't have an author for a bill like that yet. We don't have a sponsor for the bill yet, but we're not surprised because right now the legislature is running scared. And I don't know when it's going to change. Some people are frightened. Our elected officials are frightened by what's happening in Washington, D.C. Some people, you know, just are frightened. They're a little, I don't know. I don't want to do name calling, but I will. Okay, they're jellyfish as far as I'm concerned. And what I mean by that is they just don't have a spine. So, you know, this year we thought was going to be a good year because it's not an election year. But with what's going on in D.C., a lot of people in California, a lot of state legislators are, in fact, very nervous about what could happen here and what could happen to them. That's what they care about mostly, by the way. They care about whether or not they're going to get reelected. So we're making progress, I guess, is the bottom line as far as getting CP offenders off of tier three, but it hasn't happened yet. And I do truly believe it will happen. I just can't predict what year it's going to happen. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that answers my question. It's just depending on the political climate. It's just a matter of time. It's already been agreed upon.
The legislature hasn't agreed, and they're the ones that have to take action. So the Sex Offender Management Board agrees with us that this should happen. But again, the legislature has not agreed. So I just want to clarify that point for you. And here's the time. I may as well tell you, in March of next year, we will have Lobby Day. And I hope that you all will consider coming to Sacramento for Lobby Day. It's going to be one day in March of next year. I can't tell you the precise date because we wait for the legislative calendar to make sure they're going to be here in Sacramento when we go lobby them. But in fact, again, join us for Lobby Day. And somebody says Lobby Day rocks. I'm glad to hear that. And, you know, time after time, it's amazing to see people's reaction when they come and lobby. And I hear the same word. I feel empowered. I feel empowered. And Ellie, you only joined us a couple of years ago with the lobbying. Do you want to talk about your experience?
Yes. Fortunately, this past year, I had favorable experiences with the three legislative offices that I visited. There were some other individuals who basically were shoved out the door, and the legislative aide said, we're not interested. One of the individuals I spoke to was an aide to Senator Scott Wiener, and he was instrumental in developing the tiered registration law. And it was so refreshing talking to the woman, because she listened and, told us, the realities of Senator Wiener not wanting to be identified as, the sex offender, senator. But it's good when somebody's very receptive. So fortunately, the two or three times I've been with Lobby Day, it's been a wonderful experience. Weather sometimes is unpredictable in March in Sacramento, but this past March we had good weather, good people, and it's a very interesting experience because it just empowers you that you can make a difference.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellie. It's been a delight to have you join us. And not only is the weather unpredictable, how you're going to be received is also unpredictable. So I'll tell a story. This was long ago, even before we were lobbying for the tiered registry law, and went into a meeting. And by the way, during lobby day, we have scheduled meeting. Now, some teams choose to add meetings to their agenda. But anyway, this one meeting was arranged, and it was with the elected official, and we were, you know, ushered into the office and sat down in the very nice conference room and everything. And then she proceeded to basically scream at us. And one of the things that she said was, "How dare you? How dare you come into my office?" And by the way, you know, we introduced ourselves, and there were a couple of people who were required to register in the meeting. And she went on. It was in a meeting that didn't last that long, but still was very rude of her to do what she did. But anyway, she screamed and shouted about the fact that she was the mayor of a town, I'm pretty sure the city of Pomona. And when she was the mayor, she made sure that they passed a sex offender law. I think it was residency restrictions, but it might have been presence restrictions, but it didn't really make any difference. So she was very proud of the fact that she, as mayor, made sure that the city passed this ordinance, right? And so, you know, we nobody in our team lost their temper or anything like that. And we said, just thanked her for her time. And when we left, I said, okay, guess what? I'm suing that city next. And that's what happened. We sued the city of Pomona and we got rid of those restrictions. So you know what? She could be impolite. She could be rude any way that she wanted to be. But guess what? We got the last laugh. So, city of Pomona. And by the way, that is an outlier. That has only happened once in 15 years, but at least 10 years. So most of the time, everybody's polite. They're good listeners. You know, and people like Ellie, that meeting that you had in Senator Weiner's office, and they are willing to let you know basically what the temperature is of the legislature and how things are looking for legislation like what you're requesting. So we were there this year trying to find a sponsor or an author for our bill. And, you know, we didn't find one this year. So it's okay. It's important to be tenacious. I am a tenacious human being myself, and the organization is also very tenacious. So just know we're not giving up until it happens. And you've got your hand up again, 805. Please unmute yourself.
Yes, I was a little interested with this process. Does it kind of work similarly in Congress where a bill can be, you know, added to another bill that gets passed? Does it work that way?
It can. And then in Sacramento, they have this other process called gut and amend. I don't know why I always think about fish, seeing fish, and you have to gut the fish before you can eat it. But anyway, and that still could happen. So every session in our state legislature is 2 years long. So they've already passed the deadline of introducing new legislation, believe it or not. But through the gut and amend process, they can basically rip out the language or the guts of a bill that they've already introduced and basically put brand new language in there. That is, in fact, how we got the tiered registry law. So when Senator Weiner, when he agreed to be the author of the tiered registry law, he basically took this other law that had nothing to do with us, and he basically gutted out that language, threw it away, and he put in the tiered registry law language that had already been developed. And that's what went forward. And it was like the second year of the two-year session. And so that, in fact, can still happen next year. And as an optimist, I believe that it could happen. It may very well happen next year. We'll find an author for our bill, and they can do the same thing, because they introduce these bills that are like, you know, motherhood and apple pie, the virtues of flossing, you know, every night, whatever it is. And they do that on purpose so they can, in fact, do this process, this gut and amend process. But another way that could happen, too, is that they could basically take the language we want and put it in a bill that's already pending. So there are many ways that this can happen.
Can I add that I believe Senator Weiner received death threats because of his advocating for the tiered registry law. And so that's a concern, too, among those in the legislature.
Yeah, thank you for that. Rafael, you have your hand up again?
Yes, thank you for taking my time again. I just wanted to clarify an experience that I had a couple years ago. I went back to my country after 50 years, thinking that that would be my solution to get away from all this ongoing harassment in my life. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that most people that you get to meet, including your old relatives, tend to Google you. And the difficulty part of that is that here, I have the certificate of rehabilitation in my home since 1999. I've been on the registry for 33 years, and I feel more safe here than I actually did trying to get away, because once people that I met started Googling me and started harassing me the same way, I felt very unsafe. I didn't know exactly what can happen. They don't know anything about me, and they really don't have that much information about the case as they do here. Mm-hmm. So I actually had to leave, not feeling safe, and I feel safer here. So going away and thinking that that's the answer is not, because it's a worldwide Google search for everybody.
Well, thanks for sharing that story with us, Rafael. I haven't heard it before, not from that perspective. In fact, I've heard the opposite. But you make a really good point in that these days people can Google you all over the world, right? And they can find you and find out that you were convicted of a sex offense. It's a strange world that we live in, for sure. And by the way, we started registries. By the way, California started the first registry, as far as I know, back in 1947. You know, we like to be a pioneer in California. And sometimes we make mistakes. And this has just been a huge mistake that really has spread like a cancer, again, since 1947. By the way, in 1947, the only people they were tracking were people that were gay men, because they just thought gay men were such a danger, which turned out to be a huge myth. But that's how it started. And then it kept expanding. That was in the city of Los Angeles. And it kept expanding geographically. And then also it expanded as far as the number of offenses that require registration. And it's really been like a cancer. And it's so sad to see it going on. And I know my personal reason for being involved in this is because the Constitution is being, turned inside out just day after day for people who are on the register. Jay, you've got your hand up?
Yes, thanks, Janice. On the topic of being Googled, I actually paid a couple of services, and it's not all that much, like $39 a year. They will email or contact all of your websites that are, reported on the Google search and tell them to take you off. And as a result of my conviction removal a couple of years ago, there's actually no evidence anywhere of my registration or my conviction. It's all gone. So I recommend people find places that will scrub your Google search.
So Jay, do you remember who did that for you? And if you do, could you put it in the chat room? I'm sincere in asking this because I have people calling me on a fairly regular basis asking me this question. And I said, I don't do that, but surely there are some people who do. And I think, it is a good point. Like, there are some websites out there, many of the websites, not all of them, that will in fact remove you from their website on their list of sex offenders if indeed you can basically show them a document that says you're no longer required to register. But then there's some others that, that won't respond. Okay, Gus, I'm sorry.
Just quickly add that do a search for, sites that remove your Google search. I know I had one called Op3. My Firefox browser has one similarly, and I think pretty much your browsers and a search by Google will help you greatly.
Okay, thank you for that information. Gus, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I looked into this, and I think your case may have a caveat, meaning that if I understand it right, you're no longer on a registry. But if you're on a registry, my understanding is that the search optimization levels that they put on those are extremely high. So I was told by one that what they can do is they'll post articles, they'll create websites to try to get you away from page one, because like 97% of people go to page two. So if you can get yourself off of page one, that would be great. But my understanding is that the search optimization feeds that these registries give is a large number, and that you're playing guacamole to a certain degree, because you might be in Google, but you might not be in the other browsers, and it depends how they search for you and all that stuff. So if it works for anybody that is actually on a registry, I would love to hear about that, because I would gladly play for that. But my initial research showed that it was something that in essence would not work. And I can share the one that says that they guarantee that it would, and if not, they'll give you the money back. And I asked them, well, how many people have you successfully been able to do this for? And he couldn't tell me one single person. So I'm hopeful, and yes, if you can share that, that would be great. But buyer beware, I think, is my main take.
Thank you, Gus, for that information. And somebody else reminded here, it's important to remember that if your case was reported in the media, there is no private contractor that's able to remove those reports. And I know that I've tried myself contacting a few newspapers. By the way, I used to be a newspaper reporter before I became an attorney. And so, I know all about the First Amendment, and basically they do not have to remove anything. I mean, if it's true information that you were arrested for something, whether or not the charges were later dismissed, they do not have to remove that article from their archive. And I haven't found even one yet that will. But I think, too, when Jay was speaking, there's another kind of a strategy here, I think, which is kind of like burying the information. So they find other things about you that are positive, and they make sure that those go up front. Or if you're lucky enough to have a common name, that also helps a lot. All right. Member of society, please unmute yourself.
Okay. I'm sorry about the creative name, but I like it.
Okay.
I personally used Delete Me, and they deleted me, but I had to help. I had to go in and actually, they gave me forms electronically to sign, and I sent them in one by one to all these private places that were listing me, in their search results, like the background checks and all these places, backgroundcheck.com, all that. You're able to remove all your negative SO information on there. And my pictures used to be I have an uncommon name, and when you Googled my name, my picture used to come up. It does not come up anymore in the public registry. So Delete Me, I can personally say, worked for me, and I'm not paid by them either.
So that's a company called Delete
Me? Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Would you put that in the chat, please?
Sure. And you can Google it too. It's pretty easy, but I will.
Okay. But that will help people, including me, jog our memories. So somebody wrote a comment here, Facebook won't remove things either. I know, because I paid a defamation lawyer $3,000 to do it, and Facebook wouldn't. Facebook is its own little universe, I guess. For one thing, Facebook will not let anybody who's required to register to have a Facebook page. Maybe you do and you haven't been caught yet, but the fact is it's really dangerous to do that or to rely upon it, because if they find out that you're on the registry, they will immediately remove your page or all of your information, and without advance notice. And even if you're no longer required to register, it happened to somebody that I know personally, that was what happened to him. He was no longer required to register by the time they found out that he had a Facebook page, and they deleted him anyway. But here's another one, duckduckgo.com. I think I have I was thinking of the quack quack, the car wash people, duck duck or quack quack, whatever it is. But here they go. Somebody else here who will do it. That's great. I know that I have written letters on behalf of individuals to HomeFacts. HomeFacts seems particularly difficult and downright ornery, if I can put it that way, in not removing people, even if they've been, even if they have, are no longer required to register. So I've written some letters to them, and I have gotten people off of HomeFacts. By the way, I filed a lawsuit several years ago against a series of lawsuits that were requiring people to pay money to get removed from their websites, up to $500. So we shut them down that way. It cost them millions of dollars. I'm sure that person knows my name. And fortunately, I haven't heard from them in years. But anyway, I got doxxed probably by that person a long time ago. Okay, and it was worth it. Gus, you have your hand up.
Yeah, that Facebook happened to me. I had a Facebook account, and all of a sudden, I was just shut off. No head warning, no nothing.
Yep.
A word of caution over there. And I guess what I wanted to separate or distinguish is whether you can get private companies to remove the information from their website, such as, backgroundcheck.com, these kind of things. But I want to distinguish that from the fact that the registry, the actual registry, at least in my case, is something that is what populates the notification. It's not any of these other third parties. And so my understanding is that that's the hard part to eliminate because they have very high search authorization tags. And in conjunction with working with the browsers on that, they take it to be kind of like, this is my understanding, like a public service. So they will put that as a high hit. But if anybody that's on an actual registry and is able to get it off the first page, that would be amazing for me because, again, you know, the chances of them checking a second page are really minimal. And so the goal is to get it off the first page. And yeah, you know, you can create your own, you know, website. You can populate and send out stories, but then you have to maximize the search optimization tags on that so that it will appear first. And that's like an ongoing basis. But that's not the hard part. I think the hard part is just getting past the registry strength on appearing on page one. But if anybody has that, and I'm seeing a text here that I've been deleted for almost 2 years. So I guess member of society, you are still on a registry and the registry does not appear on the first page. Is that right?
He said yes.
Okay. Oh, great. All right. Hey, so okay. I hope it works for me. Thank you.
And folks, this is the kind of thing, you know, we can help each other, right? We can help each other. So one person knew about this this method, and now somebody else is able to do it. And let's you know, try everything that we can to help out each other. And again, sharing solutions, challenges. This is great. Thank you. So folks, I've noticed the time, and I will say that we normally end our meetings at 12 o'clock California time, and it's past 12 o'clock California time. So I'm just going to go ahead and remind folks that our next meeting is going to be held on September 20th. It'll be the same time, same place. And I'm so grateful that you were here today. Thank you very much for being here. Take care. Bye-bye.
And don't forget our in-person meeting September 13th in Sacramento.
Yeah. Thank you, Roger.